This is an episode of Tracing Architecture. My name is Matt Tian, one of your co-hosts.
This is Fatima Garcia, one of your co-hosts.
Today's episode is sponsored by the Arizona Architecture Foundation, and we're going to sit down with the Murphy Prize winner, Paola Perdomo, and the Samish Prize winner, Andrew Marriott. Both received travel grants from the Arizona Architecture Foundation, and we're going to hear their stories and where they went today. Thanks, guys, for coming over today to talk with us. We have Andrew Marriott.
Hello.
Paola Perdomo.
Yes.
Joining us.
So I'm Andrew Marriott, and I was the 2021 recipient of the Robert Samish Prize from the Arizona Architecture Foundation, which is a travel grant given to people who are newly licensed professionals in the Phoenix area. And I went to Morocco for my travel studies. And the reason I wanted to go there was because it is climatically very similar to the Sonoran Desert where I'm from, but culturally and historically a completely different animal. And it was, I wanted to go someplace where I was maybe a little bit uncomfortable experiencing things I had never experienced before. And I definitely got that.
Awesome.
Hello, my name is Paola Perdomo. I am currently a master's student at Arizona State University. And I am the 2022 recipient of the Sean Murphy Prize from the Arizona Architecture Foundation. I picked to go to Barcelona and Colombia because in my own pursuit of finding, you know, spaces that were designed by female architects or women design spaces, these were the two places that I found that had done a lot of work. For the scope of what I was researching, it was a lot of work or a lot of smaller works. And I think there were particular projects or particular people that I wanted to meet and kind of ask their experience. So that was kind of my foot in the door into those places and the reasons why I wanted to go. And in terms of relating it back to like my own personal experience and then my grandmother's house, I also felt like it was interesting to study them through the lens of there's a similar culture. So can that be an influence and a factor?
Paola, do you want to tell us how you heard about the organization, the travel grant?
Sure. So my experience was actually Phil Weddle came into we had kind of like an assembly for all fifth years. And he kind of gave like a little presentation of the travel scholarship, a little bit about the foundation itself. And then just kind of like, if you're interested, reach out and apply. And it was really nice because it kind of felt like he came to us, really. So it was a really nice opportunity.
Nice. How about you, Andrew?
So I had heard whisperings of it becoming a program for on the professional side, too, because it was just students originally. At an AIA associate conference several years ago, Phil Weddle was speaking and he said, I do this with my office and I want to do this with the foundation too. So that's when I first heard about it. And then I had some friends in the office at Architecton who were applying for it the year ahead of me. So I knew to expect to receive an invitation to apply for it once I had gotten licensed. And so once I got licensed, I was waiting for that email to come across.
So in applying for your travel grant, you were asked to submit a proposal outlining your desired location and goals for your journey, along with itinerary and budget. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the process so to explain for those people who are interested?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in like social justice architecture. So I knew wherever I wanted to travel to, I wanted to kind of have like that grain of importance. But then as I kind of started doing like my own little research, for us, as I was told, our kind of submission period was probably the longest one that they've had because we were told towards middle of our fall semester and then the application was in late January. So we had a couple months to really think about it. And I think it helped me really simmer it down. And when I finally started to do my research, I kind of started to tailor spaces or like experiences that I was thinking about. And that led me to different books, different resources. And one of them was kind of a way around. I kind of got into the topic of feminist architecture, and the diagrams that came out of that really reminded me of my grandmother's house, like where I grew up. And for me, what that kind of turned into was this idea of community spaces and housing and social housing and stuff. But capturing that environment that I grew up in. And so my research, the places that I picked were kind of started literally Googling, like, women architects, like, what are they doing around the world? Like, what are women design spaces? And then housing in particular. And then I tried to use pictures as much as they could to, like, kind of hone in on that feeling of experience of the architecture that I was looking for, and then tailoring kind of my itinerary in that way. So I had an idea, if so to speak.
So it's not like even in the process of you trying to find out where you go, there's like a learning experience in that.
For sure. Because I mean, for example, it helped me hone down this idea of like what spaces I was looking for. Or when I was saying I want to do like social housing, like that's a very broad term and it can encompass a lot of things. So this really kind of helped me, like, is it housing specific? Is it an experiential thing? Is it public space? Like, it really helped me also pick out where I wanted to go to, like, what I was looking for.
So with the Samish Prize, like I mentioned, this is for newly licensed individuals in the Phoenix metropolitan area, part of the AIA. So it's kind of like pretty specific. And then you, if you get licensed, you will be invited to apply for it the following calendar year. So you get the email asking to apply. And then, yeah, you had to submit, I think it was like 4 pages or so, itinerary and budgeting, looking at, you know, you're proposing exactly what you want to do, where you want to go. And my suggestion would be just like that, you take that seriously, because it's pretty clear if you don't take it seriously or not in your application. And it was a little weird when I did it because it was during the pandemic. So I honestly might have been the only person who actually took it seriously and applied. I don't know. Like, but there was, I'll put it this way. I was the only person on the like pre-submittal call that showed up.
Wow.
Oh,
okay.
Wow.
Okay. So, which was greatly to my benefit because it was just me and the 4 people from the foundation asking me, well, what do you want to do? So I basically got to pitch my trip to them right there, which was probably a little unique. Like I said, because of the pandemic, I think a lot of people just didn't even apply. But
so, Paola, you said you had a few months to prepare,
yes,
right? How long did you have, like, once you got notice from them that...
It was probably like, yeah, probably a couple months, probably something similar.
So that's a pretty quick time to like put together the budget, the itinerary,
yeah,
like lock in one place you want to travel, because I know my list is
and
long.
And you're still
right?
Making your mind about where
so
to...
So I actually had multiple places.
You did? Okay.
I did.
In your proposal?
In my proposal too. And this kind of has to do with my process too. I think like I like to travel and I like to plan things, so maybe that helped. But within putting the proposal together, it became kind of like a game of strategy of like where I wanted to go. So like for context, I went to Colombia and Barcelona. But I knew that if I traveled in May, it would be so much cheaper. So I also try to like strategize how to propose the whole proposal, even in and of itself. Like when I submitted my proposal, I even went in like, these are my dates. I chose this because I even prematurely, I guess you could say, like looked for prices too. And then thought like, is this even feasible? Or can I only just do one location? And like you were saying, like it's a matter of taking it seriously. And I think they really wanted to know what can you do with what we're giving you and how can you stretch it as much as you can.
So I guess to back up a second, how much was the grant offered for you? Like how much of a budget did you have to look for travel? And did that affect your choice of like where? Because you talked a little bit about that, but like how long you can travel really depends on how much it costs too, right?
Yeah. So for me, because I had asked that question, like, what is my time frame? And, you know, it was the summer and the scholarship was for $5,000. So as long as you can use that money, whether it's a month or a couple weeks, obviously, like they were saying, the destination like makes an impact. So you kind of start to tailor your investigation in that way. And that's where, in my case, like the preliminary budget helped me kind of hone in like what was going to be feasible, really.
Did you have a place in mind to start with too then? Or did you have a few places that you proposed?
I had a few places. I only proposed one in the actual submittal, but I had a few places in mind. And then, yes, it was also $5,000 for me. And I was definitely interested in going someplace where I could stretch my budget so that I could be longer. They definitely encourage you to be there for at least 2 weeks because you need to be able to like really kind of settle in a little bit and experience the place. So, yeah, I went to Morocco, was my final selection. And I knew like the main expense was going to be getting there. And then once there, my money went pretty far. So that was really helpful. I know this is maybe touching ahead, but I wanted to go someplace that was climatically similar to where we are, but culturally and historically like a complete world apart. So Morocco is only a couple degrees latitude separate from Phoenix. So very similar, but with much longer history, culture is completely different. And I also wanted to go someplace where I would be forced to get outside of my comfort zone, because I think that's really important to like grow as a person, not even architecture and everything aside, just experience something that you are totally not used to and go someplace where the way you live your life is weird to them.
You know? That's a good way to put it. That's right.
So that's Morocco was very interesting to me from all those standpoints, and that's why I chose to go there.
So if we're getting into that, I guess if you can talk more about your own specific trouble, what you learned from it, your experience. I know we hear from you a little bit, so if you want to start.
Yeah, so like I said, so I went to two places. I went to Barcelona and Colombia. And budget-wise, one of the things that helped in both places was that I kind of rented out a room from a family. And so it was a lot cheaper than like a hotel. And then you kind of budget your money that way of like food and stuff. And it also became experience-wise very home-like. It was less lonely or daunting, the experience, because you kind of felt kind of welcomed by someone that was already from there. But in both of my cases, there was this like thread of what I was calling like feminist spaces, right? And in Barcelona specifically, there's a lot of female architects and urbanists and like a lot of movement that's been fostering there. And so it was really interesting to see their work, kind of go and interview them and then ask them, like, what is it about the city that, what is it that they're doing, like breaking it down, whether it's like physical space or like experiential. I think a lot of my investigation was about the experience of the space, which was really interesting, especially in terms of architecture and like how you analyze the whole thing. And in the case of Colombia, it was really nice because it was a community for low-income women that had been victims of like domestic violence. And it was a community basically designed for them. And just kind of understanding that at that point, they had been living there for like 20 years. So what were kind of like the lessons learned from an experience or a project that is so budget limited, but is still kind of influential in your living because it's your house and stuff. So if I could sum it up, it was definitely about, I think it was like the sum of the experiences and other people's stories and what they look for in a space. And I think I was trying to bottle that up somehow.
So you definitely went for immersion, it sounds like. I mean, living with the families, do you eat meals with them too? And
Yeah. So in both cases, so in Barcelona, it was a friend of a friend of a friend, which was really nice because it really felt like I had known them forever. They're also Venezuelan, but they live in Barcelona. So it really felt like I was visiting family. And then in the case of Colombia, they were not Venezuelan, they were Colombians, but it also felt like extended family. And it was like, it was cooking meals with them. It was helping them with groceries. It was very much like a day-to-day, like, I live with you. You've adopted me for the summer, basically.
So, Andrew, you traveled with your family, correct?
I did, yes. I was able to bring both my wife and my daughter, who was 8 months at the time when we traveled, which was quite the experience. it made planning for the trip more stressful because I wanted to make sure everything was going to go smoothly. If it was just me, I wouldn't have planned it quite as far in advance as I did. But it was so fun. It was an amazing experience. I'm so glad I got to take my family with me. And honestly, it was interesting having my daughter there. I feel opened doors to us that wouldn't have normally been opened. It's a Muslim country largely, and they're very family-oriented. And so just the fact that I had my family there with me, some people invited us into their homes for meals, and like, it was really cool. And they just loved that she was there. So yeah, it was wonderful.
And how long were you there?
Okay, I was there. I was just trying to think about this. I think 2.5 weeks. And then we did stop at Phil Weddle's request in Paris on the way back.
So such we a were bad there request. For like,
that's a weird request to turn down.
Yeah, I know. He was like, well, if you're over there, you got to stop in Paris on the way home. Okay, you
okay,
bet. So we were in Paris for just like 3 or 4 days. And then, yeah, about 3 weeks total.
Say, I almost feel like you need that much time just to recover from jet lag, too, if you're traveling that far.
Yes, yeah. For sure.
And it sounds like you were like kind of mostly in one place while you were there.
Mm-hmm. So when I was in Barcelona, I had stayed about my whole time in Barcelona. I really tried to absorb the city, so to speak. And then in Colombia, I had to stay there for the whole time because the Eco Village where they live is kind of removed, like outside of Cali. So it was kind of hard to get in and out. I mean, I didn't have a car. A lot of the women there didn't have cars. So I was like, once I got there, it's like, I'm here. Which honestly, and I think this is why I was able to like spend so much time, because I spent a month in each one, but mostly because I was not paying for transportation. I was helping out with the food and the stay and stuff. But saving on transportation is, that's a big one.
I had a very contrasting experience where yeah. I traveled all over the whole country. We rented a car. I probably drove a total of 30 hours in Morocco.
Oh my gosh. How was that like?
It was crazy. Definitely different than driving here in the States. The first probably like 5 days were very anxiety producing driving there. Then I kind of figured out, you know, what the normals were there, and it was okay. But
the signage too.
The signage, it's like on both sides of the road. You have to look both sides. It could apply to you. And then there was like a lot of speed traps. I did get a ticket in one town because it'll be like 50 kilometers per hour to 10 kilometers per hour in a very short distance. And if you don't hit that, there's someone there waiting with a radar gun and they'll get you. And then it's not so bad in the countryside. It's just that the roads aren't as developed, but they're definitely working on them. So it's a lot slower speed limit. It takes much longer to get places. But in the cities, that's where it's really crazy driving. Because like the lane lines are just a suggestion. You can go wherever you want. You could turn, you know, you could turn right from the fifth lane to on the left.
Oh my god!
Just cut everybody off. Doesn't matter.
Talk about getting outside your comfort zone. Yeah,
yeah, it's crazy. Yes.
And then 180.
You know, there's people on motorcycles who come up and like knock on your window. You know, where are you going? I'll help you get there. And they're just scamming you to get money. Like, it's crazy. But it's fun.
It's an experience.
Yeah.
So looking back, was there anything that was unexpected that you didn't think you would bump into or learn from?
I went into it I think the whole experience was unexpected. Right before I left, I had a meeting with Phil and he was like, if I could suggest one thing, it's plan, but also plan for the unexpected. So like really be open for things that come up. And I think it was a complete 180 to how I'm used to thinking. Like I want to plan like every minute of it. But I think in both places for me, it was the idea that I had planned to get there and I had planned my duration, but then everything else that came out of it, the people that I spoke to, the projects that they recommended at that IC, it was all kind of happened on its own. And I think the lessons learned would be that there's the beauty in the unexpected, but also everyone in the whole trip was just so welcoming and so nice. And I think, especially as like me traveling by myself, it was very, very reassuring to know that I was kind of taken care of in whatever way that it happened, whether it was like, I'll take you somewhere or like when we got food. It was just the experience overall, like nothing was planned and still it was all like safe and
it still worked out. Yep.
Yeah. It takes all the doubt away, but, and it made it that much like heartwarming, I think.
Yeah. So how about you?
I think similarly, like, I don't know if it was unexpected, but it was great to feel as welcomed as I did. Especially, I happened to go during the month of Ramadan when I was there. And I was actually trying to plan around not being there at that time, just because I didn't know how, you know, I would fit in. But the way it worked out with the pandemic and everything, that was like right when the country opened. And I said, well, let's go. We got to go. So I was concerned, you know, that maybe I would do something taboo or, you know, not follow the cultural norms during this time. But they didn't care. They were super happy that we were there. So welcoming, like I said, people were inviting us into their homes for iftar, like to break fast at the end of the day. It was very cool. And then, like I said, I planned it out kind of a lot because my family was there. But there were some parts where I had no idea what to expect. And you just kind of had to roll with the punches and come what may. That was definitely the case, like in the Sahara Desert, especially. The people down there are like, there's like no rules. They kind of just do whatever they want. And so that was a little bit scary because I showed up to like some coordinates in the middle of the Sahara Desert where they're like, we'll come pick you up. And I get there and there's nobody there. So it's like, what did I get my family into?
So you say
what
am coordinates, I doing? Not address. And that's like, oh, well, yeah, that's different.
Yeah, it's totally different. And then, you know, like I finally get a hold of the guy. He's like, yeah, my brother's coming. And I'm like, oh, this is like the start of every bad movie. Like, you know, and then I get in the car. And it seems like we're going into the wrong place. And he's like, oh, I'm going to go drop you off with my brother. I'm going to take your stuff back to camp. But you just had to let go. And it was all right. It was all the right way things were supposed to happen. Everything was fantastic. But it was like scary, like just trusting.
It seems like for both of you, you were open to kind of flex your plans and welcome kind of the unexpected. But as far as the goal that you were thinking about for these trips, did that also morph a little bit or kind of get into what you were thinking, getting out of it?
I think for me, it morphed for sure because, you know, taking Phil's advice, I had to go into it with an open mind because I had basically proposed myself saying, if this trip is going to help me define how different are women defined spaces or spaces that are, you know, safe for women, et cetera, like the women experience, so to say. There is no one building project that is like housing for women. There's not one place to visit. There's no coordinates or anything. So it really became more about defining what that meant for me. And then also like, ironically, like traveling by myself during the trip, it's like, this is also kind of like firsthand research. Is this space really as safe as they claim to be if I'm here by myself and I don't know anyone? Kind of experience. And it became a way to extract those like lessons learned, but also morphed in the way that for me, it was a learning experience in that it wasn't so much as like, I've come to study this one place or this one architect, but it's like, what am I starting to learn as a future architect? What are my own ideas? Like, what do I like? What feels comfortable for me? It was really empowering for me, at least in the whole experience, to really figure out that like, I can not just come here and visit, but I can also say that like, oh, I didn't like this or I liked this. And I really do feel like it kind of gave me a little bit more of a voice and in kind of deciphering certain aspects of design that I liked. So overall, at the end of my trip, yeah, there is no one project that I found that I could say like, these are all the things that are defined. And according to all of, you know, all of the architects that I met, this is the one project that meets all of these criteria, but it was a chance to see different projects, just like different types of housing. Like Barcelona is doing a lot of like collective housing and like collective ownership, which is just a completely different way of thinking about housing in general or the office. Or so I think it was more of like, what's out there for me, even if it wasn't like one particular project, so to say.
I don't know that my goals changed much, actually, while I was there, which was interesting. I mean, my main goal was to immerse myself in it and just experience what it's like and hopefully learn something from the way that they live and from the structures that they build and their cities and towns. And we were able to do that, and it was amazing. And, I mean, we spent the night in a like 500-year-old Adobe Casbah. There's no electricity, just candles at night. And it's been owned by the same family the entire time. So we got to do some really cool stuff. And I've got everything out of it that I could have ever wanted and more. So
what about the impact on you professionally? Like now coming back, like how has that changed how you've approached your work?
The thing that really struck me was how centered around people the design is there in their cities. In the Medinas, in the old parts of all the cities, it's either no cars or very few cars. So you can go several miles without ever getting on a street where a car can go. And I wish I remember the statistics, but it's like a few million people living in a very small area. It's kind of wild. So just the idea that everything is centered around the human was very nice. They're very, like, everything is passively designed because they don't have the technology in these old parts of the cities. So it's, you know, using courtyard spaces and dense, like, rammed earth and adobe materials. The thing I didn't like about it was because it's so dense and everything, there's no nature in the city for the public. The nature happens inside their homes, in their courtyards. So that was nice to have like the reprieve from the craziness of the city in your own home. But then there was, you know, in like one city in Fez, there was like, I could probably count on one hand the number of trees that I saw in the whole city.
So tree is not even like parks or outdoors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it's just all, you know, cobblestone road and adobe walls, and the streets are probably, there were parts where I had to turn sideways to kind of sift through, and you know, at most they're like 4 or 5 people wide. So I felt like that was wearing me down by the end of the trip. I just felt like everything is so crazy and so hard. There's nothing like soft except for when we got to go into the courtyard houses and stuff like that. Then it was, you could breathe a little bit, you know? So that was interesting, but the density is definitely something that I took back, something I'm thinking about a lot now, because the footprints in which they live and everything, you know, they'll have 3-4 generations of people living in a very small home that's like 800 square feet on the ground floor, but they're going 3-4 stories. And so the amount of people you can pack in is pretty incredible. And like I did some studies of these houses and stuff while I was there and realized like, okay, this house is the size of 3 parking spots.
Wow.
Like how many people could we fit if we like used our land better, you know? So that's something that the gears have been turning on, you know, since I've gotten home, and I've been, you know, designing some fun stuff on the side. But yeah, just thinking about density and designing for the human as opposed to the vehicle like we do in the United States.
And what months did you go again?
I went March.
March, and the walkability, it says people are walking and it's a similar kind of weather than we have.
Yes.
And people just...
Yeah, it was maybe 5 degrees cooler when we were there. I mean, okay, so the north is coastal. So the north would be more similar to like San Diego if you're on the coast, I would say. But then once you get down into the Sahara, it's hotter than it is here and way more arid. So, yes, it's similar for sure to here.
Yeah.
And the homes are comfortable without, a lot of them don't have air conditioning. And I was cold at night, you know, so it's interesting.
So lessons learned, or like how I'm approaching, I think similar to Andrew, I think this idea of designing for people. Whether I knew it subconsciously or not at the time, like I said, I was very inspired by my neighborhood at my grandmother's house. And I think I was finding a way to kind of encapsulate that in a bottle or you know, kind of bring it with me, mostly because I kind of just assumed this idea that this concept of like living in community was maybe something that was more cultural. Like maybe that's just like how it was in Venezuela. Like people are just more open to being out in public and just amongst other people. And I know that moving here, even though I was at a very young age, I could feel the difference of like everything is so much more individual. And I think for me, like I said, whether it was subconscious or not, I was trying to kind of find the justification of, is it cultural? Do we really not want to live in community? And like, what is the architecture that kind of breathes that? And so I think what it has actually done was kind of inspire me more and kind of given me this conviction that like, whether there could be this like essence of culture, I think there's also that architecture that can exist either encourage us to be more in community or it just kind of leads us in that direction anyway. And I think lessons that we wanted to learn in COVID too, like, you know, we, as much as we really like our individual space, we as humans really crave the community. And I think we've learned that a lot of those spaces aren't naturally conducive to that. And so I think moving forward for me is, I mean, I do love the architecture, but I do want to have that focus in mind of who we are innately as people and like how we naturally come together and like what are those spaces that kind of brings us together and how do we bring that more here? How do you dissipate that with like climate? And like, I didn't go to a particularly desert-like climate, but especially in like the case of Colombia, like where everything is passive, even though the weather is different, like how do you rethink the resources that we have and still not sacrifice this idea of like living in community is kind of my takeaway.
And it sounds like for both of you, these lessons are, they're not architecture specific in like a certain type of art, like commercial or healthcare or anything like that, but more fully general lessons. But is that kind of changed your internal thoughts on where you'd like to take your career after having that experience?
I think it actually reinforced it in a way. I don't know whether I want to do residential or community centers or whatever the case may be. I think where I stand now is like, I think these are lessons about architecture. And I think architecture is, we should be reminded that architecture is how we live. And then what are those spaces that we live in? And so whether it's healthcare, whether it's residential, there are these like innate human needs, whether it's social or physical, that I think should be within every project. I do like the scale of housing though. And I think coming from such a personal experience too, I think I do view housing, for example, as something that is so much more than where we go to at home. I think it has a very huge impact in how we form ourselves and who we form ourselves with. And so there's that kind of aspect. So maybe not stray too much from residential, but I do like other kinds of projects that I'd be open to for sure.
I want to do everything.
Who
I
doesn't?
Always have, you know, like life's too short to just do the same thing the whole time. So no, I don't think it changed like, you know, what kind of sector I want to go into or anything like that. But like you said, just kind of like the more detailed parts of it, the sensitivities, I guess, there are things that I'm thinking about still for sure. So I guess we'll see how it impacts my career, but yes, it's changed how I think about things, I guess. Yeah.
So it's part of being open to new experiences, right? Like Open to learning things as you keep going.
Right? Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So you talk a little bit about the process of applying and all that. What about leading up to the travel and thinking kind of that time between you got selected, you know where you're going, maybe you're going to start doing more research about the culture, the language and everything. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so logistically, right? So like when I was putting the proposal together, I had kind of mapped out where I would go, how much money would be, et cetera. So I think once I got the scholarship, it was, okay, now I have to make everything concrete. Like, who am I going to stay with? How much am I going to rent the room for? And there was that logistical side of it. Architecturally, going into it, because, like I said, I was coming from it in the point of I'm inspired by this sense of community that I've gotten from my grandmother's place. And in essence, I'm kind of looking for those same things. So for me, it became a concept of analyzing my neighborhood architecturally and kind of developing an informal kind of set of ideas or spaces that I was looking for and kind of seeing if I could find those places where I was abroad. And for me, it did kind of become like a treasure hunt in the unplanned, and that like I don't know everything that I'm going to see, but I kind of know the spaces that I'm looking for. And so every day I was setting out to look for those places. And it changed, you know, like I thought that it had to be spaces that had a courtyard, for example. But, you know, it was learning to see that community can happen in the sidewalk. And then what were the components of the sidewalk? So there was a kind of fun little study of my own grandmother's like house that I did, which in and of itself was even its own kind of curious investigation, because it had been 10 years since I'd gone to my grandmother's house. So a lot of this study I was also doing based off memory and like stuff that I had, you know, grown up with. And so it kind of became this memory of place and then analyzing it through the eyes of an adult now and not as a child, and constantly gave me an excuse to call my grandma all the time and ask her all these things, and realizing that everything was twice the size that I remember it because I'm no longer child size. But it was very interesting to kind of feel like I was delving into architecture even prior to the trip.
Yeah, and it seems like when you talk about that, how you remember the house that you haven't been in 10 years and more architectural experience you have rather than that type of place and the details that you're looking at. And it sounds like both of your experience got more into that you see, oh, there's no trees on the streets. What makes me feel where I get my relief? So kind of that to me is a very important like lesson there. Like it's about the experience and how architecture contributes or not contribute to that. So on your case, how do you do a lot of research on Morocco prior?
Oh, yeah. Lots of research. Yeah, I didn't have you had a past experience to kind of like go off of and mold your trip around. Mine was all about diving into the unknown. So the weeks leading up to and months leading up to actually going were the most stressful part of the whole experience for me, especially because it was still during the pandemic. It was the tail end of the pandemic. So I had set dates a couple of times, and like Morocco as a country would open up and then it would close back down. So I had to keep pushing it back. And that was stressful, because trying to figure out like, okay, do I actually like book all the places I'm going to stay or not? Is it going to close again?
So are you going to get stuck there?
I was terrified of getting stuck there, but I decided, you know what? It's open. We're just going to go. And if we get stuck there, we're supposed to get stuck there, you know, whatever. Like it is what it is. Everything worked out great. But it was the logistics of it all that was the hardest part. Mostly with traveling with a baby. Because, you know, I had to check and make sure, like, okay, can we bring a crib on this flight or that flight? Or can we fit our whole family in this place or not? You know, what accommodations do they have for children? So that was honestly probably the bulk of my research was figuring out if I could do this with a child. But then everything, I guess that kind of set the expectation a little bit, was everything I read online was like, if you have a kid, you have to go to Morocco because they love kids there. So I was like, okay, like this is perfect. This couldn't have lined up any better. Also, I should mention my daughter's name is Atlas, and it's the Atlas Mountains is the main mountain range in Morocco. So anytime somebody met us and they asked, you know, what her name was, it was like instantly they loved us because they thought we named her after the mountains, but that was just pure coincidence. But it was also a coincidence that made me select Morocco in the end. I found out that I had received the grant at her baby shower. And so then I was like, well, this is all lining up. We're thinking about naming her Atlas, the Atlas Mountains. Like, this is crazy. I have to do this. Like, this is definitely where the universe is pointing me, you know? So it was awesome.
I will add, though, like, I can't imagine what it was like to plan for, during the pandemic. I think I had a little bit of a blessing in that mine was very much tail end of the pandemic. And even though I had to plan logistically, like, there was a lot of planning, like my vaccines and everything. But literally, as soon as I started, as soon as I got there, it's like every country was like, whoa, everything's over. Like, you don't need to quarantine here. So I think planning with that, I can't imagine the logistics that went into that.
It was kind of weird because this was like here at home, we were still all wearing masks at that point. And masks were mandated on the flights and all this stuff. But it became very clear, like on the flight from the States to Morocco, that that was not going to be the status quo. Because it was like we were pretty much everyone on that flight was Moroccan besides us. So it was like, okay, this is what it's going to be like. Huge families. Everyone was running around in the plane. It was crazy. And then the second we got off the plane, we didn't see another mask the entire time we were there. So we took our masks off, which was weird for the first time, like after a long time. We're like, hey, I don't want to stand out more than I already do. So I'm just going to do this. It was totally fine. It was kind of weird because they don't have like as robust of a like medical system as we do. So it was weirdly not as big of an issue there because it had just devastated them so early on. It had kind of run through the communities and done a lot of damage. But by this point, it was kind of over for them. So it was really weird to like see that and like flip the switch of like, okay, we're going to take our masks off. This is different now. Like, but it was great.
Yeah. Especially to see the impact on the community afterwards too. Cause that's.
Yes. I mean, for example, like one of the tanneries we went to, they do a lot of leather work in Fez. I think he said they employed like 1500 people prior to the pandemic. And it was about 400 when we were there.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, and I asked, I didn't want to, you know, like make people sad, but I kind of tried to ask like gently, you know, how bad was it? You know, like, you know, a lot of people died and it was, but we're picking, and it was really bad in terms of like nobody was going anymore. And they're heavily dependent on tourism in a lot of these places. So they're like, we're kind of just, you know, rebuilding. We're glad you're here. So, okay.
Yeah. That's fair. So has your outlook on travel in the future changed at all based on this experience?
Yes and no. I love traveling. And I'll, even if it's like around the corner, I'll take any excuse to do so. I will say that if anything, I feel like it ignited like a little travel bug. Like there's so much more that I want to see. And because I feel like it was so maybe experience oriented, I would maybe say that my travel, future travel is more inspired of like, okay, obviously you want to hit all the highlights of a place, but then what can you do to like really understand the place? And I would say both of the places that I went to felt kind of familiar to me. So I'm very open to more places that are unfamiliar to me and kind of that contrast and experience. Maybe another travel lesson would be definitely like try to be more open for the plan for the unexpected. So many things, so many wonderful things come up out of that.
I would say it definitely like opened my mind like to, okay, nothing's off limits now. I can go anywhere and I'll be fine. Prior to this, like I had only been, the only place I traveled outside of the contiguous United States was Italy and London. And that was like 2 years before this. So this was definitely a jump into the deep end of like, okay, we're just going to see how this goes. And yeah, now I feel like I could be totally comfortable going anywhere. But it also kind of made me realize, okay, I need to like alternate trips, comfortable, non-comfortable. Because I was so tired when I got home. And you just like, you kind of always have your guard up when you're in uncomfortable situations. And so it was when I got home and kind of was like, oh man, I didn't realize I was so tense. Like I had so much fun and it was wonderful, but yeah, it realized, okay, maybe I can't do that for every trip, but I can do it. I can go anywhere.
So you're looking for that moment of reprieve.
Right? Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It's like the discovery traveling and the resting traveling.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yes, a vacation exactly. From your vacation.
Yes. Yes.
So do you have any recommendations for people who are on the fence about applying?
I would say apply. Whether you know 120% where you want to go or whether you don't. The thing that comes to my mind is that saying, like, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take. I think even the application in and of itself was a really wonderful experience because you had to submit your proposal, then you got a top five or like finalist selection, and then kind of for the interview. So it really became a lesson of like, okay, is this really where I want to go? Like, do you have conviction in what you're saying? The process of felt really much kind of like an interview, if you think about it, a chance to present your ideas. You have nothing to lose. Like, the worst that could happen is that you don't get it, but there's so many other things that you can apply for. No one's grading you. No one's there to tell you you're wrong to choose the place that you picked, because if you can tell someone why you picked it, they'll believe you. And I think the experience overall was very, very, very wonderful. So yeah, I would say do it, even if you're scared. I know I'm scared a lot of, you know, kind of jumping off the edge like that, but it was so worth it. So worth it.
My advice is very similar. Just do it. Just apply. Like, I kind of touched on this already, but the field of people who are going to apply is so small. Like, your chances are actually really good if you take it seriously. Because, you know, it's the Phoenix metropolitan area. People who were just licensed in the last year. Okay, that's small already. How many people are actually going to apply? Even smaller. How many people are going to take it seriously? Even smaller. So if you do your due diligence, do your research, and you take it seriously, your chances are really good. And this is like an amazing opportunity that you're not going to get. Things like this don't fall on your lap that often, honestly. Okay. And then, like you said, the worst thing that happens is you don't get it. And if you took it seriously, well, you have an amazing trip planned that right, you can do for yourself.
Exactly.
Afterwards.
That's so true.
And you're more likely to do it because you put in the research and the time and effort into doing it. If I didn't get the grant, I probably would still have done this trip because I did the research. If I didn't do the research and I didn't get the grant, this is probably something I never would have done because it's like so out there. So that's all I say. Do it. Take it seriously. It's an amazing opportunity.
I also feel like it gave me the chance to ask for help too. Like, you can't solve everything on your own. And I obviously didn't know everything on my own. And really awesome conversations came out of it. And because, you know, like, as we're saying, you wouldn't do it if you didn't have this opportunity in front of you. And there's a lot of people that you probably wouldn't talk to if you didn't have this opportunity. And there's a lot of people that you're like, well, maybe, I don't know, like, I'm not asking for a job or whatever. But if you just come up to them and be like, look, I just need you to look this over for me. This is something that I'm looking into. Like, what do you recommend? I think was also a really cool experience. And for me specifically, like, not being from the Phoenix area, I feel like it was like the perfect excuse to kind of talk to people and be like, oh, here's a topic of conversation. And it was fun. It was, yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. So it gets you like that first kind of push into the community with the Arizona Architecture Foundation and meeting the people there and getting to talk with them.
So yes.
That alone is a great opportunity.
As an introvert, I'm telling you, I needed the excuse to talk to people sometimes. And this is perfect. This was perfect.
And then I'll add to that. Part of the experience was, I mean, I don't know for you, but for me, I was like required to blog while I was there. And they were posting about it here, linking people to my blog while I was there. And so even now, still, we're a year later, people that I don't know in the architecture community are like, oh, you went to Morocco. How was that? So it's like an immediate icebreaker to get to like talk to people, which is really cool.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So introverts apply.
Yes.
Please do.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you guys very much for coming in and talking with us today. Really appreciate it. Hope people are interested in applying with this and they're inspired to travel, even if they don't win the prize, but yes, to do the research and go out and see the world.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
We want to thank Paola and Andrew for joining us today, and thank all of you for listening.
This episode was sponsored by the Arizona Architecture Foundation. You can always follow us on tracingarchitecture.org or send us your ideas and questions to tracingarchitecture@gmail.com. Thank you.